Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We had the New Hampshire primary last night that was basically in line with what we were expecting. Bernie Sanders won. There was some expectation that he would win by a bigger margin than he did, but he won, and so Pete Buttigieg came in a very close second place,
within like 2 percentage points.
Yeah, pretty close, right? and it decreased over the course of the evening. I think
tightened up.
Early evening, I think Sanders was maybe. What it was maybe like, you know, 27 Sanders, 20 Buttigieg, or 22. Yep. So Buttigieg caught up over the course of the evening. And then another big surprise, although it's a little unclear kind of whether it matters or whether it means anything, was Amy Klobuchar coming in a serious third. And
with about 20%.
Yeah, about 20.
19 and a half, 20, something like that.
Right. And the, you know, again, not a big surprise from the vantage point of a few days ago, but certainly from the vantage point of much of the last year, that Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren just also ran like way back behind.
Single digits.
Yeah, high single digits. What, they both got 8 or 9, yeah. Something yeah. like that. Which is, you know, battling for fourth and fifth place, which is whether you supported those two or not is just sort of is just pretty wild.
Yeah. I mean, it was a sign of the race or his standing that Biden wasn't even in New Hampshire last night. He had skipped town to go to South Carolina.
Yeah.
Which is not even the next
yeah. voting.
Although
contest.
It's the big one for him.
Right, right.
It's his quote-unquote firewall, right?
Right. You know, and the funny thing, Robert Gibbs was on TV last night, I think on CNN, maybe MSNBC, and he was a big, I think his role was chief, you know, communications person, press secretary for Obama in the 2008 campaign. Then he became the White House press secretary, which I think he did for 2 or 3 years. Any case, he was on last night, and he pointed something out that sort of obvious when someone says it, but I had not quite thought about this, that you have, now tell me if I'm right here. So basically, Nevada is a week from now, and then South Carolina is a week after that, and then it's like 3 or 4 days until Super Tuesday. And he made the point that, like, let's say Sanders kind of underperforms in Nevada, and let's say that, you know, Biden kills it in South Carolina. Now, you know, not just holds on and wins, but like smashing victory, and you're seeing all these like, oh, comeback Joe, blah, 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 blah. Even if that's the case, the whole key with Super Tuesday is you need money to be running ads in all of those states, big, big states. And there's just no way that, again, even, and these are highly debatable hypotheticals at this point, but even if he kind of gets, if Joe Biden gets exactly what he needs, he's still not going to have probably any money or after that big blowout win, any time to raise money to be running ads in those states. And so, you know, to a certain extent, you know, paid ads, not everything. There are debates, people get a lot of free media and stuff like that. But it shows you the wall, his back is up against.
Yeah.
So,
Well, let's.
It's a tough situation for him.
Yeah, let's take care of a little bit
of Warren.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take care of a little bit of business, and then we can dig into more of these results.
Right. So remember that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can brew it yourself with Grady's New Orleans style coarse ground coffee blend designed to work in any cold or hot coffee maker. One bag makes 24 servings of Grady's Cold Brew exactly the way you want it. Order online and receive 16 ounces of their famous blend of 100% Arabica beans and French chicory in a resealable pouch for long-lasting freshness. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. Or you can order Grady's at Amazon.com for next day delivery. You know, I was emailing with a TPM reader in China.
Oh, really?
I think an American expat in China. I don't know how many native Chinese readers we have in China. Hopefully, some. In any case, he was largely talking. I don't remember exactly where he is. I don't think he's in Wuhan, but he's in China. So this is a much more immediate thing in China with the coronavirus. And he was kind of telling me about that. And then he mentioned about the podcast and Grady's. And he said how he's like, I really want to try Grady's, but I guess, and you know, this isn't Grady's fault, but I guess when you get it shipped to China, it's distributed everywhere in the United States now, and it's available in some other countries. But I guess if you buy it in China, you know, someone has to kind of like UPS it over to you or right. something like that. And so he thought it was too expensive. But you can see the demand.
Yeah.
For Grady's. Even people are just holding on from coronavirus and they're like, dude, I need some Grady's.
Hey, points to him for trying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe he'll hear this and think like, dude, maybe just spring for the shipping.
Yeah. Just splurge once, give it a shot.
Yeah.
Happy Valentine's Day. Have some coffee.
Well, you can also, if it is a weight of shipping issue, you know, Grady's also has these pouches of, you know, coffee grounds,
right.
basically. So that way you can kind of, you know, maximize your Grady's consumption and still keep it real on the shipping charges.
Yeah. No, avoid all that water weight.
Yeah. I mean, because why are you, seriously, why are you shipping water
so
across,
there is no excuse, sir.
No, there isn't. You know who you are. And I actually don't because I forget your name. I apologize. But we discussed this. So like, you know, it's I don't think there's been any studies recently. But Grady's might even like, you know, if it's touch and go with coronavirus, you know, I shouldn't joke about that. You know, anyway, trying to have a little levity with what is obviously a very serious situation
absolutely.
In China and in other countries. And we even have some cases here in the United States. I think the only thing I've been following this pretty closely, and the one somewhat positive thing is that it seems like it is not that transmissible. It's clearly transmissible by casual contact. Otherwise, it wouldn't be exploding in China. But it's interesting. I was reading an article in the Times, and they were talking about epidemiological breakdown, different pathogens and how they spread. And obviously, there are things like hepatitis and AIDS, which requires, you know, some volume of direct exchange of body fluids. And then you have other things like measles, it's not just like I'm standing in front of you and I sneeze and you breathe in some of that, you know, contaminated air. It can actually go, I think it said measles can exist in the air for like 100 feet.
Wow.
So like if you're in like a subway car, and one person's at the other end of the car and they sneeze, like you could actually get it, right? And it can persist on surfaces for long periods of time. And then you have this maybe for selfish reasons, what I've been watching pretty closely is the structure of transmission in the United States. And most of the people who have tested positive for it in the United States came from China, like seemed to have gotten it in China, and then they flew over here not knowing they were infected. And there have been a few cases of transmission in the United States, but those all seemed like people who were like living in the same house or like taking care of that person. So, and that is obviously somewhat good news about the ability to possibly arrest or slow down the
I was interested in reading one of your posts about this, Josh, in just the increase in travel to and from China as compared to like the SARS outbreak in, what, 2003,
yeah,
I guess it was?
Yeah,
is it something
yeah.
like four times as many kind of
right,
trips in and out of the country? Or
I think this was basically train and air travel, period. So a lot of that is internal and some of that is external. But yes, four times. And you know, maybe showing my age a bit, 2003 doesn't seem that long ago, 17 years ago, but it just shows you the very different epidemiological world that they are living in there. I mean, again, four times as much air and train travel. That's huge. So it really means that...
And it speaks to what a kind of rapidly, upwardly mobile Chinese population, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the story, in many ways, it's the story of our age, the explosive economic growth of China. And that means huge amounts of infrastructure, which means a lot of transportation. It means whether it's a middle class or not, it means a larger and larger percentage of a very large population having enough disposable income that you say, you know, you want to go on vacation to Beijing or you go on vacation to, you know, I'm not sure exactly where one goes on vacation inside China from China. But yeah, so that is, you can see, I mean, the SARS thing was different in a few different, in a number of ways. But you can see, you know, obviously when you're dealing with a disease epidemiological crisis, ideally you want people to be not mobile at all. Everybody stay right where they are, right? And so that just shows how much more challenging it is. And it's really kind of amazing when I was reading that article in the Times, like how much data there is. Like they know how many people flew out of China into the United States in the window of time when the infection was live and until, I mean, basically now the travel shut down.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, again, yeah. if you can separate yourself from it being a very sobering, scary topic and one of great heartbreak for a lot of people, the amount of data that epidemiologists and public health officials are dealing with is fascinating.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have to do a whole separate episode sometime
yeah.
on it.
Yeah.
But anyways, we can get back to American politics. Kate, you wrote a piece just before we came in here, kind of looking at the split among the moderate vote. We talked about Klobuchar performing well, mm-hmm. Buttigieg a close second after, you know, essentially tying, or maybe I guess he got one more delegate in Iowa than Sanders.
Yeah, it's this endless debate about who really won.
Right.
It's basically a tie.
Tell us about what you wrote and kind of what you're kind of looking at across the campaign.
Right. So I think, you know, I kind of wanted to write about this after the, as it's been termed, the Kloba surge yesterday.
Klobentum.
Yeah. So basically, I think what we can take from that and from the only two contests we've had so far is that moderate support right now is very scattered and kind of like unsticky. It seems that these people don't hugely have a horse that they're backing in the same way that people are backing Sanders. Like, I think if you look at the progressive nugget of it, it's a lot more predictable. You know, Sanders is benefiting at the expense of Warren. He's been at the top of the pack. She's at the bottom. Whereas with the moderates, I think the support just doesn't seem to be so shored up to me. And even though you can extrapolate some trends from these first two contests, I think looking ahead, you realize that just how messy it is because, you know, Buttigieg has done well in these first two contests. So maybe you say he's the moderate front runner. And then you look at Nevada and South Carolina where he's mired in the single digits. And there hasn't been a lot of polling since New Hampshire. It was last night. So maybe he gets a boost. You know, maybe he does a bit better. But he hasn't really demonstrated a whole lot of ability to coalition build with non-white voters, especially who make up a much bigger part of the electorate of the next two states. So
And are almost totally unrepresented in these first two
states. Right, exactly. So you say, you know, where is Buttigieg's momentum going to go? You know, if you predict that fizzles out and that Biden gets, even though, you know, he's been dinged from these first two contests for sure, has had worse than expected finishes, even in places like Iowa where he didn't expect to finish all that high. You know, if he rises in these next two states and Buttigieg falls, you know, Klobuchar is nowhere in the pollings for these next two states. So maybe she gets a boost from her bronze in New Hampshire. But if she doesn't, we say Biden rises at the expense of those two. And then the narrative of the moderates has totally changed again. And there's no clear moderate front runner. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders is getting this lane to himself because there doesn't, at least so far, seem to be a huge split among that coalition between him and Warren. Seems like she's kind of been tailing. And I think most worryingly for her, even though the Biden campaign is kind of limping into these next two contests, she was never really hanging her hat on either of these places to be like, I'm going to take hits, but I'm going to come back. And in the memo her campaign released yesterday, it seemed to be a kind of calm down to her supporters. The path they traced to the nomination is basically just a mishmash of delegates they're hoping she'll get from a series of like top two finishes during Super Tuesday states. But, you know, that means her plan hinges on getting through four full states without a top place finish and somehow still having enough momentum to pick up delegates in these next states, you know, as Michael Bloomberg looms in the background and throws fistfuls of money into advertising. So on the moderate side, it's just things are really, really in flux right now. And that's not to say that there won't be some coalescing at some point, but it seems that there's not a ton of time to do that. And right now, the very clear beneficiary of those factions is Bernie Sanders.
Right.
You know, another way to look at that is that, you know, Sanders has a, you know, the one thing you knew was not going to happen in New Hampshire is like, oh, Sanders collapsed and he went down to 5%. I mean, not only is it not going to happen after he did well in Iowa, but he's got supporters. It's not like, you know, you run into a Bernie Sanders supporter and they're for Bernie Sanders. It's not like they're kind of still looking, you know, they're for Bernie Sanders. And in other primary, in other primaries, when you have a person who has really dedicated support, they've notched up a few solid wins, maybe Iowa was a tie, but you know, whatever, you start the other, I mean, people who are shaken off from Biden or Warren, he's going to pick those people up and suddenly he's over 30% and over 40% and other people's money starts drying up. And maybe that will happen, but I think the other way to look at the flux on the, you know, to me, it's not even like the moderates. Like Klobuchar, that's the, she's playing that. To me, Biden really isn't. Biden is just sort of like down the middle sort of baseline Democrat in the, you know, in the last decade post, you know, post Obama, whatever. But it really seems to me that, again, he's not building those other people. He has that group, but the other, so, you know, people abandon Warren and Biden and they prop up Klobuchar or they're going to Bloomberg. And so I think that...
Wait, Buttigieg is who you're talking about not being able to draw those people or Biden?
Now I'm confusing myself. What I'm saying is that you have Biden and Warren who are falling quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And one day those numbers are going to Buttigieg. Another day they're going to Klobuchar. Another day they're going to Bloomberg. So they're running all over the place. They're not running to Sanders.
Right, right.
And again, the way these races are supposed to work and usually do work is that one person has a strong base of support, they start having wins, they start looking like a winner, and people start kind of gravitating towards them. He has not shown the ability to make that happen. So, and you know, from what was his final, like 27, 26? What was
26-ish, yeah.
Okay. So that is not a bad... That is certainly not a bad showing with a lot of people in the race. But that is not a, you know, it's kind of not a front runner showing either.
Yeah, we were talking before we started to record that in 2016, he got 60% of the vote in New Hampshire. And again, it was about it was like a two-person race.
Yeah, it was a two-person race.
Time, but
yeah, I don't think there's anything, there's what I am suggesting here is certainly not proven on the basis of these two races. We're going to see in the next few weeks. But I think there's a decent amount of evidence to show that he is having a hard time breaking out of being a factional candidate.
Well, and I also think that's because he doesn't, that's not his brand to be a unifier. So he, it's not like he's putting all his energy and trying to bring people together and they just won't budge. You know, it was something we covered the New Hampshire debate, or the debate right before New Hampshire primary in Manchester. And, you know, I was kind of on the lookout that whole time for signaling from Sanders that he was going to try to ride out this front runner, this new front runner status, you know, with Buttigieg, but or to kind of signal to people, you know, I'm on track in Iowa, in New Hampshire, in Nevada. Here's my new like front runner persona I'm putting on. And he like made one comment about how he'd be willing to compromise with Republicans on common ground once he got into office. But aside from that kind of cursory lip service to the idea of being a unifying candidate, it's just, it's not his brand. He's the outsider. He won't become a real Democrat. You know, it's, that is his thing. And that's what people like about him. And they like his consistency in that.
I saw an email we got from a New Hampshire reader who was at an event of his, and, or, you know, sometimes they have these events where it's kind of everybody, you know, everybody's invited and everybody gives a little speech. And she said that he did seem to be showing some of that, that he had kind of his, I don't remember the ins and outs of her email, but that he was kind of doing that. We're all Democrats. I mean, you know, most of us are, not you, but, you know, but you get the idea. We're all Democrats. We have to come together. And you're right. It's not his brand, but more than that, it's not kind of characterologically him. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's often is the case in politics. The thing that is your greatest strength is also, can also be a weakness. And I'll tell you again, my big concern about a Sanders candidacy has always been a Sanders general election candidacy, is that the general election would be, you know, half against Trump and half against the, you know, quote unquote, Democratic Party establishment, which in my mind, often what he is talking about the Democratic Party establishment is like Democrats, right? Because sure, there's an establishment, but it's not, this isn't like a ward boss situation in Chicago in 1950. What you're talking about, kind of the you know, ideologically unsatisfying things that Democrats seem to do and the kind of candidates they seem to support. And that is not a, I don't think that's a recipe for victory, because you've got to get everybody pumped. And if a significant portion of the people who you are trying to get pumped, you are basically running against, you know, sort of like in a civil war situation where kind of like, are you going to come in and, you know, come behind our lines and admit what you did wrong? You know, I know that's a bit overstated, but it, that really is the question to me. Can he do that? Now, obviously he can't come in and say like, hey, you know, I might put Joe Lieberman on my ticket, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got to stay who he is, but there are signals that he can send, kind of like, not everybody agrees with me about everything. That's fine. But we have a terrible person in the presidency. Mm-hmm. We're going to get together. We're going to run a race, bring together all the different people who really have had enough of this presidency, and we're going to win. And you know, so I think you can do both things. It's not clear to me that he has it in him to do it. And the other thing is that, you know, at a certain point, you become captive to your supporters. You can't do what is really inimical to them. And that's an issue, too. So we're really going to see. I mean, at least what I fear and half expect is that he will continue to be the sort of the rump front runner through these races, like maybe getting the most votes, but getting the most votes with like 25%. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Biden quickly, because Josh and Kate, something we've talked about on the podcast a lot over the last few weeks and maybe months even, is that poll after poll of general election matchups against Trump show that Biden consistently beats the president, right? And that he's, for the most part, Biden has been like out in front among the other Democratic candidates. That changed a little bit this week. There was a Quinnipiac national poll that showed Sanders for the first time leading, I guess, leading the Democratic field.
Well, actually, Bloomberg was by, but they were all pretty close. I think Bloomberg actually had
the biggest
I think it was, maybe Bloomberg by 9 points, Bernie by 8 points, and Biden by 7 points,
right,
or something like that.
So what do you make of the position Biden finds himself in now?
My biggest fear about him is that it's an organizational issue. Like, I read an article about how their precinct captains were untrained during the Iowa caucuses, and they lost people on realignment because people didn't know what they were doing or how to count. And the fact that he announced that he was leaving New Hampshire for South Carolina while the polls were still open was, like, shocking to me. Like, I get maybe you don't want cameras on you in your watch party when you're coming in fifth, but you're going to project to the entire state that you're just giving up. And that is something that's concerning to me, because he, of all the candidates, is, for better or for worse, unpolished, usually uncalculated. That's the flip side of his authenticity. But so a candidate like that needs a staff to, like, polish this stuff. And when reporters, came up to him and were like, "Why are you leaving New Hampshire for South Carolina?" The most obvious question you can ask, he's like, "Oh, there are more states than just this. Blah blah." It's like, you don't even have a good answer.
I would say. I partly disagree on the New Hampshire thing, because I think they were going to get crushed. And so kind of nothing to lose. And also, you can kind of say, when your girlfriend or boyfriend breaks up with you, "I never loved you anyway." Right. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting ahead of it. But I agree with you on the Iowa stuff. And I think I remember talking to someone who was like an Iowa precinct captain or involved in his campaign, like in either 96 or 88 or when, sometime in the distant past, and that it was kind of similar. And, it's not the candidate that does that kind mm-hmm. of stuff, but, fish rots from the top, right? Or from the head or whatever. So I do agree with that. And I also agree with you that, there's this... there's this thing of people saying, like, "Oh, everybody said Biden was so electable. Here he is in fourth place, womp, womp, womp." Well, the pervasive thing through this whole process is it's a different thing in a primary than a general. Mm-hmm. That should be really obvious. It's not obvious to a lot of people. It is entirely possible. In some ways, it is even likely that someone who would be the best general election candidate might really struggle to get traction in a if you think you hear hammers, there's someone doing construction.
Joys of New York City
across in the building next door. So we apologize, but we're gonna not pretend it's not happening. And I probably it'll end in a second. That's not surprising. Because to a great extent, obviously, what you need to do is you need to energize your own people. But to a great extent, it is how many of those people who are, it's not just the people who are quote unquote moderates, it's people who aren't like party affiliated, who are kind of floating around, aren't too ideological, how many of those people you can get. And I think the polls have shown Biden has more reach into that world, especially in the upper Midwest. Having said that, at a certain point, it's hard to be coming in fourth and fifth place and like maintain just a sense of like, "Oh, you're going to kick,"
Well, I think that's a good point. And I think that kind of, what I was saying earlier about him being the best general, not the best primary, is that his qualities that I think make him a really attractive option against Trump are his empathy, his likability, his kind of like geniality even. And those qualities all stem, I think, from this base of comfort that, Biden would be a empathetic consoler-in-chief type. And for people who are really worn out by the constant, hatred and vitriol that Trump spews, that is really comforting. But for someone who's looking to get amped behind a candidate who's promising revolution or change or fresh ideas. Biden is the stability candidate, so that's not what he's promising.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I have not really counted Biden out yet, but I think I don't know how you become, how you balance both things. I don't know how you're both.
Yeah, I haven't counted him out yet. Not so much because, I mean, by any normal standards, these two first showings, he'd be like toast, basically. Mm-hmm. The one thing is, he's the former vice president, and that just gives him a certain buoyancy that the others don't have. Sanders is in a small national lead now, but that's only very recent.
Yeah.
That could certainly fall back down if things shift a little bit. So he's certainly very high up in the national polls. We've seen how evanescent that can be. But the other thing is that, again, if it's true that Sanders has a hard time expanding out from like a quarter of the Democratic electorate, someone's got, you know, there's got to be someone else out there, just because that leaves 75% of the electorate up for grabs. And so, if Buttigieg were a different candidate, to me, he's a very, I don't want to say he's a niche candidate. I think it's that he seems to appeal to a relatively narrow slice of the Democratic electorate. So I don't think it's going to be him, and you're kind of like process of elimination. It's going to, you know, someone's going to, it's got to land on someone. Now, the new factor here is, well, Mike Bloomberg, who is, you know, I saw this thing that he's already spent $300 million. Yep. I mean, that is just, I didn't know he had already spent that
much
money.
And he's going to double some of his ad spending, right, after Biden's collapse, I guess, in Iowa.
Okay, the thing about Mike Bloomberg, first of all, I looked up his net worth for the story I wrote right before we came in here, and just $61.5 billion, okay? Whatever, I can't even conceive of like a million. But moving on from that, it's just, he said this whole time, he's like, I will be there if Biden falters. Like, I'm going to make sure that I'll be the fail-safe gap. You know,
He actually said that?
Yeah, that's what he said at the beginning, that when he was considering his candidacy, like, we'll see if Biden is too weak a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. But while you're scuttling around in the background, shoring up Super Tuesday sites for yourself, you can't say, like, I'm not contributing to Biden's fall directly, because he is. He's giving people another option. And people who are being barraged with all these ads from his virtually bottomless pockets are like, well, Biden's doing terribly.
Yeah.
And here he is.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a push and a pull. I mean, if Biden were killing it, there wouldn't be the oxygen for Bloomberg. So his rise is, I think, to a great extent, a measure of Biden's weakness. But yes, he certainly is catalyzing it. Absolutely no question. It is such a, it's a weird thing because, you know, I lived here for most of Bloomberg's mayoralty, and I certainly watched from the very beginning. And there were two big negatives. The one big negative is that he held on to a lot of the aggressive policing policies that he inherited from Rudy Giuliani and were interpreted, I think it's now clear, wrongly as being responsible for the dramatic drop in crime in the city. Stop and frisk is the sort of the key, you know, poster boy of that, but it goes beyond that. And then the other is that someone told this to me one time, it may have even been Bill de Blasio. This is weird. I actually interviewed de Blasio when he was running the first time. In any case, maybe it wasn't him. Someone told me this, but I think it's generally understood that Bloomberg's vision was you make Manhattan sort of a playground for affluence. And that creates a tax base, and use the taxes to kind of do cool things for everybody else. And certainly in Manhattan, he did a lot of things that were great. You know, a lot of kind of change, you know, kind of new urbanism kind of stuff that I certainly liked. Bloomberg, it's not just a spin that he's been a big force on climate. I think he spent about $500 million closing down coal plants. He has for the last decade employed an army of lawyers who every time a coal plant comes up for recertification, they go in there and just bludgeon it to death and it has to be closed down. So he is like, he's been a huge force on climate. He's big on the gun thing. So there's a lot of things that progressives care about that he's not just on that side, that he has spent a lot of his money on. The big thing, I mean, again, the stop and frisk thing is a big, big problem for him. There's certainly smoke about at least a very kind of locker room culture, to use Trump's phrase, at Bloomberg, at the company. And I think he has even said, like, you know, inappropriate jokes in front of women. And I don't think we know. I'm only being vague because I don't think we know the whole thing. These are obvious shortcomings in a candidate.
Well, and not just Trump. Shortcomings, but you're talking shortcomings with black voters and with female voters, a.k.a. the backbone of the Democratic Party.
And that's the question. I mean, Bloomberg had a lot of support within the African-American community when he was mayor.
Which you can kind of tell from polling, because all of the black vote basically that's been leached from Biden has
gone
to
Bloomberg. Yeah. So if you set aside those issues, in some ways, you know, the sort of the Bernie left DSA crowd has this concept that they have articulated about neoliberalism. And I think it is a very problematic one, because neoliberalism actually has 4 or 5 relatively distinct definitions. And the people in that world tend to, you know, anybody who's not for Sanders is a neoliberal, basically. In some ways, Bloomberg is the best of what neoliberalism has to offer. And what I mean by that is, and I say that in the context of the ways in which neoliberalism has largely failed. And I would, for these purposes, I would define neoliberalism as a governing model where you basically give markets pretty much free rein to markets, free rein to capital. You then use the taxes that generates to give it to policy experts and technocrats who will use that money to do a lot of good things that liberals want. Okay. Now, that is kind of Bloomberg's thing. And there are much worse versions of neoliberalism. That's kind of the best version of it, right? But it's still that thing. And he is still, he's a Wall Street Democrat. Now, I think he has recognized that he can't go into a Democratic primary just like that. So I guess he's put out a wealth tax. He's saying inequality is sort of a centerpiece of his campaign. I just say all that it's pretty weird that we're here. Right. Yeah. But I do think for a lot of people who are committed Democrats, not terribly ideological, really more center left, they look at it and say, you know, we could do a fuck of a lot worse. And in fact, we are doing a fuck of a lot worse right now. This guy has billions of dollars. He's picking up support. He's got he seems to be able to get under Trump's skin and take it to Trump.
Yeah, Trump was tweeting about him last night. Bloomberg or something.
Which totally part of that is, I think people, it's easier in your head to see a one-to-one matchup. And obviously Bloomberg is like far wealthier than Trump. I mean, we think, no one really knows how much money Trump has.
Well, even based on Trump's own.
Yeah, what he says he has.
Even on what he says he has.
Exponentially,
that he's, that he's multiples. But it's quite, yeah.
But I mean, the idea of, you know, putting that aside a little bit, you've got like 2 New Yorker businessy type guys who have got a lot of money, who, you know, get in New York scraps, like they're not afraid to go after each other. And I think that kind of has given people the idea that like Bloomberg could could take him on due to his pockets, due to his background, due to their similarities and those kind of superficial ways.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound kind of fun to watch a Bloomberg-Trump debate, doesn't it?
I just don't... I think any of them would trounce Trump so thoroughly. I don't know.
I think any of them would trounce Trump thoroughly on the bases that we judge debates by. It's not clear to me in terms of its political effect. I mean, look, someone just emailed a little before we came on the air and made the point like, look, the one I'm worried that what is, you know, driving Bloomberg forward is everybody thinks that maybe he's the only one who can get it done, when in fact Trump is a historically unpopular incumbent that really probably all these candidates could beat him. So let's not like run off to another billionaire. And let's be clear, not just a billionaire who owns a news organization.
Right.
That is a big, big problem, right? Now, I don't think, I certainly assume that if he did not divest himself, Bloomberg would be a lot, he would not be sleazy the way that Trump is, but he still owns a news organization. And
it employs, I mean, thousands of journalists around the world. It's one of the biggest, probably, headcount in the world. Probably.
Yeah, it is really hard to see how you, you know, absent him selling it, which, again, this is always the, I mean, at this level, like, who's going to buy it? Joe down the street?
Right.
No. I mean, it's one of the biggest companies in the world, or, you know, certainly one of the biggest news organizations in the world. That is a whole problem. And I will say that when he was mayor, the idea was that he obviously hadn't sold his company, but he had like, you know, turned it over to another CEO. I'm not involved. I think the general consensus has been that after he left being mayor, it kind of came out. He wasn't quite so uninvolved. And like, it's not surprising. It's your company.
Right.
You're really not going to take
name,
a phone
his
call.
His name is
when
on
a,
the building, right?
Yeah, when a big decision is made, you know, it's, you know, but I think he would really, I think he would do very well in a debate against Trump, because Trump would go in with a lot to prove and a lot of insecurity. And, you know, Bloomberg has the, you know, the big billionaire energy, right? It's that thing. I'm worth $60 billion, you know?
I mean, but
you're not.
That part
you're
of
a phony.
It, that's also just so deeply concerning to me.
No,
along with the outlet, the idea that you can not bother at all with the first four states, even first six, really, and that you have enough money to buy it after
and,
that.
And really, it's not even like the first four or six. It's really all of them. He's basically saying, I'm not going to run in the primary. I'm going to run a TV national campaign, and I'm not even going to pay attention to these other people. I'm running against Trump. And I think that has been a big strength. So yes, he can, his money. Now, I would say he was mayor of New York for three terms. That is not.
He like changed the rules in order to get the third term. Is that right? Something like that?
Yes. He had them change the rules
cool,
to make.
Cool, cool.
But I mean, my point is that is, and it was a good period for New York. So, you know, kind of an easier time than some to be reelected a few times. But that demonstrates some real political skill. So I don't think we can say, well, anybody who just kind of threw up all this money.
I mean, Tom Steyer. Not money to the same extent, but he's pretty much, I mean, he's made the debate stage, but no one's ever really taken him seriously. Yeah.
And he's never gotten any traction.
Right.
So I get, my point is, I don't think we, it's not just money. There are things that make him an attractive candidate for a lot of people. Mayor of New York is a big position. He did it as sort of a national thing. But yes, his money allows him to just opt out of the intra-democratic primary process. And, you know, billionaires are, there is no question that billionaires are one of our big problems. I'm not against someone being a billionaire, but, you know, you've got Trump, you've got his billionaire cronies, you've got Jeff Bezos, who like is really kind of bringing it to Trump and the thing about whether the Saudis hacked him and then this lawsuit, but he's another billionaire. So it's like we're living in Gotham City, right? Yeah. Between the big, you know, the big billionaires, and now maybe Democrats have another big, and maybe he's a good billionaire. So it does, you know, yes, it is part of the problem. I mean, having said all that, I think that there is a very big difference between a authoritarian rightist nationalist billionaire and a billionaire that would probably govern in a fairly conventional way. I think that is a huge difference, but it doesn't make it nothing. Yeah. Right. It still makes it that it is, he is part of the problem that is one of the bigger problems in our society today.
Yeah, my ending note is just the precedent of using money in an election that way, even though already our campaign finance system is a shambles, yeah. But that's just such another level. When you can spend $300 million like it's $5, yeah, I mean, blink. Where does yeah. it end?
Yeah. So. Well, we'll see him on the debate stage for the first time next week.
Because
is that
they
right?
changed the rules. Yeah.
Well, is that confirmed? I thought that it seemed like he would get the polls that he needed, but is it actually confirmed now?
I guess I don't know if it's 100%. The reporting I saw, I think, yeah, was assuming that he would be on the stage. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I thought
in the next few days.
I thought I saw something a few days or two or three days ago that said like looks like he will, but so far he's only has one poll that would count.
Yeah.
I'm actually, you know, it's funny.
The Q poll that came out a couple of days ago, that has to account for something too, right?
Maybe that's the one. I have no idea. Maybe I was misinterpreting something. I mean, I actually don't think there's anything wrong with that rule change. I don't even really think it's necessarily a rule change. I mean, they have changed the rules for each successive debate. Each one has had different rules. The other thing, first of all, the party should not be running the debates. That is a bad, bad idea. It didn't used to be the case. It's basically partly an outgrowth of what happened in 2016. I think they may have done it in 2016 to an extent.
I think so, because there were a lot of those Saturday night debates that were supposed to kind of lock it in for Hillary, right? And not sort of give Bernie the edge. Or that,
right.
That at least was the kind of the argument.
That was the Bernie line, yeah. Right now, it seems like he's basically in third in the national polls.
Bloomberg, right?
Bloomberg. Yeah. It seems absurd on its face that you would keep that person out of the debate. I don't care what the thing is. It's just, that makes no sense. And I think the crazy thing is that the other candidates are saying, hey, he's getting a free pass. No one's asking him any questions. Well, get him in the debate. So,
I hear you. I think that ire comes from people who are mad that Cory Booker and, you know, Julian Castro got boxed out because they weren't doing well enough for a myriad of reasons. And I think optically it looks shitty to have the rich white man get to be in the debate when he wouldn't have gotten to otherwise, while the candidates of color, one of whom is a sitting U.S. senator, failed to make the stage. Yeah. And I think there are a lot more factors behind both of those things, but the optics are just kind of weird.
I agree with you. I mean, optics are subjective.
Yeah.
To me, it's just not the same because, you know, especially Booker, I really wanted him to get traction, and he wasn't my candidate, but I really liked him. And so I was very disappointed with that. But the reality is, both of those candidates were failing to get any traction, and that is why they were excluded from the debates. It wasn't that they were coming on strong, and some obscure rule made it so they couldn't get into the debate. They were not getting any traction. That is just objectively the case. With Bloomberg, he's getting lots of traction. He's third. He is rising quickly, and he's in third place. Now, his money is a necessary condition of that. Absolutely. So it sort of all grows out of the basic issue that he's a billionaire. But I don't buy this idea that, oh, you know, they kind of changed rules for Bloomberg and didn't change the rules for Booker and Castro, because
what rule would they have changed?
Yeah,
for
what
them?
Rule would they have changed? I mean, would they make it
diversity rule or something?
Yeah, and I think that is
I totally hear what you're saying.
I think that's a real
I think you're not wrong.
That's a problem. And I guess the idea was basically, I don't think that's what they were asking for. They were basically saying, hey, just let more people in.
Right.
Like, you know, kind of pull the benchmarks down. And there's a logic to this. I mean, I guess what it comes down, I mean, again, this is why parties should not be running the debates, because you can have one news organization say, hey, we're just inviting the top people. And another one says, hey, you know, you guys come and maybe kind of shame that front runner into coming. It just, it attaches the party to decisions that are it's hard to be fair in a way that everybody thinks you're fair.
Right.
It's just a bad idea. Hope they give it up for next.
Yeah.
Next.
Cycle. All right. Well, I think we're out of time, so we can leave it there. But we'll have coverage of that debate next week. I think, Kate, you and I are working that, so stay
and
tuned.
And what day is it?
It's on Wednesday, I want to say.
That sounds right.
And then Saturday is Nevada, so another busy week.
Life comes at you fast.
It does. But this weekend is nothing.
That's right.
This is a bye weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Before and the next, to the next, the next two weekends are Nevada and South Carolina. And then
right.
Super Tuesday. So the fun won't stop.
Yeah.
All right.
Remember, the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. If you're ready to give it a swirl, get 20% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TBM. Or order Grady's on Amazon.com for next day delivery. All right.
All right.
Later, folks.
Bye.
Thanks.